Damaged Goods Podcast.
But yeah, Damaged Goods, you didn't come here for that shit. You came here for some other shit. And I might break this into a two-parter because it got more rich in depth as I researched. That's right, I researched. Not that hard. I know most of this shit off the top of the brain. And you know I'm a man of leisure. I'm probably not doing too much heavy research. But I did a little bit on this one. And what I'm going to be discussing today is the notion of the Sophomore Jinx album, specifically within the realm of hip-hop. Yes, the Sophomore Jinx. I believe the Webster's Dictionary defines the Sophomore Jinx as, disclaimer, Webster's Dictionary probably doesn't have Sophomore Jinx in there. Although it might, dude, fuck, they add crazy words all the time. But it basically, yeah, sophomore album, your second album. People come out if they have a really, like, shit, some people have classics that are their debuts, which we'll talk about here. And even if it's not a classic, just if it's a good debut, right, gets good reviews, sells records, whatever, fans like it, it puts a lot of pressure on the sophomore album, the second one, the follow-up. Can you live up to it? If you can get past the second one, that's when artists have, you know, careers that span 3, 4, 5, you know, 15, whatever albums. The second one can really be make or break because depending on what the first one does, if it's a classic, like we'll see here, you can almost never live up to it. And you're always, you know, while you have the fans who fuck with it no matter what, you're always going to have a critic drawing back to your first album and, you know, measuring everything to that, and you'll never live up to the hype, and it kind of just haunts you. And it also makes it easy for music journalists to have something to write about when they're fucking non-creative and, you know, they can't come up with anything. They'll be like, oh, can blah 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 ever match the fucking success of his first album, blah blah blah, because that's how they sound in my head. You'll see that. And even if it, like I said, even if it ain't a classic album, if it's just a good album and the second one falls a little short, you know, it's like, am I going to check the third one? You might not even know the third album came out. And it sucks because you might stumble on that second album trying to either recapture the first or maybe go in a different direction sonically, and you lose fans. And you want to come back feeling more grounded on the third, but ain't no one checking because, you know, fuck. Some cats, as we'll see, first album, not so good. It's kind of miraculous that they even got a shot at a second album, that they didn't get dropped from their label or no fans would check for them, because the first one, if the first one really sucks, like if it tanks or doesn't really draw any attention, why the fuck are people going to check for the second one? You might think some artists improve with time. A lot of people do in the realm of arts, you know. I mean, like a boxer's first professional fight, you think they're as good as their, you know, third, fourth, fifth. Your first major league sports, you know, game, like, you know, MLB, you pitched your first game or two, you think you're fucking nervous? Of course. Second season, maybe, okay, shit, I don't feel so nervous being in the big leagues or the cameras on me. You might get more comfortable, but with music, people might not give a fuck by that time. Like, yeah, it's especially now, dude, it's such a fucking saturated market. So in hip-hop today, we're doing that because I particularly, personally, Double P's, have a lot of albums within the realm of hip-hop that I personally, particularly, love the second ones of some of these artists a lot. Very impressed whether they, you know, dropped the first album that was fire and they just happened to be sick enough to follow it up. Or some of these cats whose first albums were like, and the second album was a game changer, not just for how we took it as fans, but the artist almost completely changed or improved to a level that you're like, whoa, I didn't see this coming at all. And sometimes it just takes a little of that time, or maybe they were working with the wrong producers and executive producers on the first one, or who knows. So we're just talking about Sophomore Jinx in the realm of hip-hop. Albums that are, I'm going to first talk about the second albums, the sophomore albums that are better than the first, that outdid the first. Because that's the thing. Everyone's like, Sophomore Jinx, It's going to suck. These are the ones that are better. And then at the end, or if I break this into two parts, it'll be on part numero dos, the sophomore albums that did fucking suck, that were jinx, that were fucking basura, ass cheeks that you never want to listen to. In my research, meaning mostly my off the top of the head and memory knowledge with minimal research, most I have more, I should say, sophomore albums that were better than the first than sophomore albums that were truly jinxed and that fucking tanked and you're like, well, this is crap. There were some that were good, maybe not as great as the first, but still a good album. You liked it. We're talking jinx means that shit sucked. It flopped. It you know, that the first one was a fucking fluke. How did you get through the gates? Maybe it was timing. Maybe you had one really big single. Or there's certain producers you had that you don't have here, or it shows that you're not a great artist, really. You had songwriters and people behind you that, you know, were able to help you or manipulated the industry. Who the fuck knows? But your second shit was crap. Bye-bye. We have less of those than the second albums being better. So, I guess without further ado, let's get into it. And I will say this is a Jake the Snake Damaged Goods podcast disclaimer before we get too deep. Miss Me with the Nas, It Was Written is better than Illmatic shit in this talk. Please, 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 please. Listen, I'm a huge Nas fan. It Was Written is fire, dude. It's either my second or third favorite Nas album. And if you want to know why, it wouldn't be right off the rip the second. It would maybe be The Lost Tapes. Some people won't consider that a proper Nas album. So fine, if that's the case, then it would be my second favorite Nas album after Illmatic. But I know it's a very cool, popular fucking take on the shit. For years, Illmatic is not only revered as Nas's best album, his debut, but also like maybe hip-hop's best album, one of the top classic music albums of all time. And it's become pretty cool in the last 10 years or less to be like, you know what, actually, It Was Written is better. I mean, it was commercially more successful, but there, you know, it wasn't a 5 mic off rip. It doesn't transcend time like that. I could go on about it. It's just a cool contrarian take. And I'm a dude who loves to go against the grain, but I don't go against the grain just to be a contrarian. I just tend to not trust things in the majority. I appreciate things that are, you know, passionate, that come from the soul and true creation and not, you know, the manipulation of big business and you know, popular interests and shit. And It Was Written is great, but I don't think it was better. I think that's a cool, fun, contrarian argument people like to have to say that he was nicer on the mic, which is arguable, or what, the production was cleaner, you mean more commercial? So, I mean, I don't know, dude. Like, it's just a silly take that I think people like to do. Some people like to just go against the grain to be the person to stand out. You stand out when you're on that contrarian thing, but I don't think that's really the case with this one. I think, you know, I just think Illmatic's better, but whatever. They're both great, though. That's the real thing you should take away. They're both fucking great, so let's not get into that. This is in no like chronological order. Chronological order? What am I, smoking chronic? This is no chronological order. I'm going to be bouncing around a lot, so don't be mad if one album's like from, you know, 5 years ago and one's from fucking 25 years ago. I don't want to hear it. We're going to start off with, since I'm in L.A., an L.A. native, a very popular artist of the times, guy I'm a fan of, Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar's first album, Good Kid, Mad City, fucking, you know, regarded as classic. I am a millennial, but I'm on the tail end of that. So, excuse me, I'm fucking allergied out, throat's fucking full of ganja smoke and what have you. I'm on the tail end of that, so my younger millennial friends who are, you know, on the beginning of that, whatever, this is their Illmatic. They fucking love his first album. I dig it. It's dope. Production's tight. It was hard for me with his voices. Like, he throws all those weird voices. I'm like, what the fuck, dude? Really not into that too much at all. And it made it hard for me to sweat that album. I fucked with Section 80, his shit before this, and I was aware of Kendrick for a while. But the voices made it really hard for me to love that first album like it was a classic off rip. And they were like, it's a concept album. It's a concept album. Okay, what was the concept? I really couldn't get it. What, just a kid in the city growing up? Like, that's a really vague, wide umbrella of a concept. I think there's very few concept or themed albums in hip-hop that are truly that. And, you know, that's the one you're going to measure them all up to better be fucking Prince Paul's Prince Among Thieves. I mean, that's a hip-hopera, you know, to use the term he uses. That's a true concept-themed album. And there's a lot of other ones, but I need to feel the theme. There has to be some cohesiveness to the songs. It can't just be some abstract interpretation that makes it a concept album. Maybe theme, and theme is lighter than concept. Great album, nonetheless, but whatever. How to Pimp a Butterfly comes around a few years later. a lot of anticipation, a lot of hype, right? This is the second album. He hasn't done a lot between the two. Where's he going to go? He goes in a sonically in a different direction, bringing in a lot of production and sounds that I was really fucking with at the time. You know, he brought in Pete Rock. He got Thundercat, Flying Lotus, Pharrell. Sounds that would kind of become cool and popular in music around then, not just within hip-hop. And if it wasn't hip-hop, it was because, you know, Kendrick and a couple other cats were bringing these vibes in. But outside of hip-hop, a lot of the other indie music I was listening to was like this. But it still fit because the whole album had this vibe. Sonically, I felt it was warmer, a little fuzzy and thicker. And it didn't go for the quote-unquote commercial sound at the time, which Kendrick never does. I respect him for that. But it was huge. The hype was crazy. Like right away when it dropped, I remember dudes were like, it's a classic, it's a classic. All the blog, this is still when blogs still kind of, you know, had some pull and what have you. Right away it was a classic. And I usually shit on anything like that when people call it a classic off rip. I'm like, dude, let it live for a few months. Where, you know, you're in the streaming era where you forget a month or two later that an album even came out that you love. So let's chill on that. But this is one of those albums that it really was. Is a classic. It lasted for me. The songs that were the hits, quote unquote, the singles are fire. They're not corny commercial ones. You can vibe with them. And this, I wouldn't even call this a concept album. Maybe a theme, and that's loose. But sonically, it was cohesive as hell. It was fire. I loved it more. He did less of the voices. It was either that, or he finally wore me down, where the voices weren't bothering me as much, or they didn't stand out so much. But I really dug this album. I thought he took a chance on it. He could have followed the same kind of vibe of the first one, which is the safe play a lot of dudes do. And I'm not mad at that. If that's what your fans want and you give them what they expect, they will reward you with loyalty. It might shrink your commercial appeal, but it takes a lot of nuts to venture into another sonic realm, especially one that's not the commercial one. Like I said, this shit was popular on a more of an indie level. But it wasn't like the hits weren't like, you know, in line with the hits of other artists at the time. So to do that is ballsy, especially when you've already got momentum off your first fucking record. I respect him for that. I respected Kendrick for that. And he did it, and he did it well. And I dug the record. Fire. Next, we're going to talk about Common. Common Sense at the time. His second album, Resurrection. He, you know, had to switch it to Common because of lawsuits of some kind, but it was Common Sense, Resurrection. There was a period in my life, mostly when I was like in early, like high school, I guess, where this was like my favorite album, and maybe, or whatever. Or there was like a year or two where Common was my favorite MC, but this is Common Sense, Common. And I got on to Resurrection a little later. I knew about his first album, Can I Borrow a Dollar, which I'll talk about more in a second. And just briefly saying, when I was aware of it, meaning I was aware of it, what I heard, I did not fucking like, I didn't entertain it. So Common Sense drops Resurrection. Also, like, didn't really check for it because of whatever, but then you start hearing the praise and the reviews and people talking about it. Then you hear I Used to Love Her, which is one of the first uses of personification in hip-hop that I could think of. There's a few others we'll mention in here. On other albums, he's talking about I Used to Love Her. He's talking to hip hop like it's a girl he used to date, a love, and describing the, you know, the growth, the arc, the existence, the current state of hip hop at the time, but also as if it was somebody that he loved and still loves, but maybe the relationship had grown bittersweet or complicated, if you will. Ridiculous, has been emulated by so many artists talking to hip hop like it's a woman. So many people have done that, you know. And that's fine. It's beautiful. That's something that Common laid out on the floor for. And definitely one of the best uses of personification in any fucking hip-hop song. But Can I Borrow a Dollar, if I can go back to it for a second. I loved Resurrection so much that I went back and copped it. I think I copped it after his third album, One Day It All Makes Sense, came out, because that was also a stupid album. I fucking loved it. And this is a guy who was so rich in skill. Like, you know, he had the surface level shit he would hit you with you loved. And then the shit that you had to rewind a few times or that you caught months later because your friend's older brother was like, yo, you don't get this part. Plus the production was sick. And so I was like, you know, let me go back and check the first one. Okay, you know, I went to get a Newbury Comics on board, No, I went to the Newbury Comics on Newbury, I think, to buy this in Boston. Used one. Of course I'm going to buy this used, thank God. And, you know, if you heard Resurrection, his second album, which is not Jinxed, it's a classic, dude. Five Mikey, if you put me at the source. If you heard kind of One Day It All Makes Sense, you go back and hear Can I Buy a Dollar? And just to keep it fucking funky, dude, and be frank, it sucked. I think it sold like 2,000 copies at first, which maybe nowadays it's like, whoa, that's cool. Dude, 2,000 copies in the early 90s, that's when they were selling a lot. That's bad. All right. He was rapping like a Chicago Dos Effects. And I was a Dos Effects fan, but to hear him doing it, and he didn't have the crazy similes and metaphors and wordplay, and his nasally flow was not as cool because he was rapping so fast and juggly, and it was awful. Resurrection had these rhyme schemes that were crazy. His flow was a little slowed down. The wordplay was nuts. And the production, dude, he had no ID. Doug Infinite, why not? That production was timeless. No big features at all on Resurrection, which, dude, no big features at all on any big album, whether your debut, especially your debut, or your sophomore, Jinx is huge. Big features are used by labels. Listen, you don't know this artist? Well, we got this guy on his, or this girl on his record that, you know, is popping, and you like them, so you're going to check it. Oh, okay, I like that. And these couple artists are on that. Those must be cosigns. This person must be good. Now, everybody gets paid, man. Everybody gets paid, especially if there's a major inside. So, you know, you see your favorite artist on some no-name person's shit. It's not as much a cosign. It's fucking money, unfortunately. You know, like, shit, man. Resurrection was sophomore Jinx fucking blows that phrase out the water. Some people had no idea Can I Borrow a Dollar drop. So for a lot of people, this was Common Sense's, Common's debut album. And it was so good, dude. People were like, yo, this dude is like on a whole nother level. I don't know if there's any project, which I'll talk about today, where the sophomore album showed this much of a growth and skill for a motherfucking MC than this project right here, than Common right here. Listen to these two albums. The contrast, it's not even night and day. It's like night and day plus a couple centuries in fucking between, dude. It made him like one of the best. And Heads knew it. Even if he was on a radio or Top Vids or BET and MTV, he was, especially when his third album rolled around, people were like, you know, yeah, these guys are the best because they're selling the most and they're on the radio and they still can rap. They're still nice. But this dude from Chicago, this dude Common is fucking nice. And Chicago had, you know, some MCs at the time, but now you got one that cats are calling one of the best out. You know, I Used to Love Her, I think, really kind of helped solidify that. You can talk about Nas, I Gave You Power, or Stray Bullet by OK, Organized Confusion, which we'll talk about later. But this whole project was creative, sincere, honest, and I definitely loved Resurrection. I still do. Gotta buy it on vinyl. Next sophomore Jinx album that was not Jinx, that was better than the first, Cypress Hill Black Sunday. I remember I was in like seventh grade. I was, you know, in the midst of about to hopefully lose my virginity to my girlfriend who was in eighth grade, and super, you know, excited and geeked off of just being a fucking horny young 13-year-old kid smoking weed and skateboarding and all that. And Cypress Hill drops this shit, and it had big hits that got him in the limelight. You know, their first album was cool, had some joints. This puts them in the limelight. Really Insane in the Brain was the big first single. But this is raw. This is Mugs on production. This is these Cuban and Cuban Mexican dudes from LA that don't have the West Coast sound. They don't really have the East Coast sound, but a little bit. But they're raw. They're not doing commercial shit. And the video for Insane in the Brain was kind of rugged and raw. They're performing live. It looks all trippy. And this whole album just blew the fuck up. And it was big. And that's when they started really touring a lot. And then, you know, this album, and really the next one, they would tap into what would be kind of like their own fan base, really, really, you know, relishing and embracing the weed smoky culture. I mean, they was all about it in their music, but embracing that, maybe going into it a little harder, and it would translate to their fan base being like that, whether the fan base was hip-hop heads, West Coast, East Coast. I mean, dude, I'm an East Coast kid. East Coast heads love that. And sometimes it wasn't the purest hip hop heads that I knew, like the people that would really fuck with this shit, would be these weird kids who were skaters, I would know, but not skaters who were bumping like Gangstar and J-Ru and Mobb Deep. They were like, you know, more into the rock shit. But they fuck with Cypress Hill, and they would go to these concerts, and Cypress Hill would be playing shows with not just rap artists, but other kinds of music. And, you know, you look at it like, I mean, it sounds cool, but what's the deal? But they were establishing a legacy, man. They were selling out shows, and they would continue to do that for 20-something years, 30 years. And, you know, they didn't even have to have huge hits, although they would. They didn't have to dominate charts and videos, but they would, without selling out, without even getting a lot of love from like hip hop publications. Like at the time, The Source was so important, and they had beef with that. I think they were burning The Source magazines. And, you know, Muggs would go on to do other production, not just for West Coast, but East Coast dudes. So, you know, you'd see him transcend. And I think that gave Cypress Hill more appreciation for other hip hop fans. And yeah, fire ass fucking album. All right. Organized Confusion. Just mentioned them a little bit ago. Okay, Prince Po, Pharoah Monch. Pharoah would obviously go on to have a pretty successful solo career later in the late 90s, Indie Bloom, Raucous and all that shit. A lot of people who probably fuck with Pharoah then might not have been aware. Him and Prince Po had an ill-ass group in the 90s, and Prince Po was nice too. He's on Internal Affairs, sorry. I'm thinking of the great Chinese movie Infernal Affairs, which Scorsese's The Departed is based on. But he's on that on a dope record. But they were labeled in the 90s. Organized Confusion was labeled horrorcore, along with Grave Diggers, the Flatliners, all this shit. And maybe the first album was, but it's really funny that they were, because they're not. I don't know why, but this second album, the second album, Stress, The Extinction Agenda, 94, great East Coast 90s, you know, mid-90s classic. It removed that stigma of horrorcore, because horrorcore almost felt kind of like a little quick wave, a little quick trend. Even the Gravedigger's second album didn't really roll with the horror theme. Prince Paul wasn't on production. RZA was. It felt like, you know, a 5% album in a lot of ways. Fire fucking lyricism, fire fucking records, storytelling, but it didn't have that horror vibe. They shed it too. Maybe why that second Gravedigger's album didn't get as much attention. Anyway, the second OK album did. And it had that song that I mentioned earlier, Stray Bullet, which is another personification shit, rapping from the point of view of a stray bullet being shot, you know, and you know what happens from that. Anyway, fire second album. Tribe Called Quest, Low End Theory. Remember, again, Jake the Snake disclaimer, Damaged Goods disclaimer. Not all these second albums mean that the first album was bad. A lot of them mean that the first album was good, but the second album didn't jinx. It held up. Some of the times, like the common shit, the first album was fucking whack as hell, and the second album saved their life. Either way, what I'm just talking about is how good the second album was. There was no jinx. Tribe Called Quest, Low End Theory. One of the best hip-hop albums all time. It might not be Tribe's best album. It might be. That's up for debate. We ain't doing that right now. But think about that for a second. For many people, People's Instinctive Travels was the beginning of, I don't know, which is, you know, some people might say like the Native Tongues were forming. And it was dope. These dudes were having fun. They weren't some pussy-ass dudes, but, you know, they weren't talking about some gangster shit. They weren't slanging and banging. They were cursing, but they weren't over-cursing. They weren't embracing the, you know, there was an element in hip-hop where some people were trying to capitalize on, hey, if we're a little raunchy, a little wild and crazy, it'll get us attention. There were some dudes just doing that because that was purely them, like the NWAs, you know, the fucking Luke and a lot of cats. Like, they weren't trying to do that. They just were that. And then some people might be like, look, if we're a little wild, it'll help. Anyway, Tribe wasn't doing that. Native Tongues wasn't really doing that. And It let the MCs, the production, and the vibe take motherfucking center stage. You know, Queens dudes. These is Queens dudes. And, you know, you had Tip Productions, Fire, Boom Bappy vibes, great samples. Fife is up there holding his weight. You know, yeah, Check the Rhyme was a huge record. Butter bugging out. It was not jinxy. And, you know, Tribe would go on to have a crazy run. They wouldn't have a sophomore jinx. Their thirds and fourth, their albums would just hit. They had a run. All right? Mobb Deep, the infamous. Dude, you know how many motherfucking people I've met throughout my life, hip hop fans or whatever, that don't know that there is an album by Mobb Deep before the infamous, Juvenile Hell. They're young as fuck, dude. They're like 15, 16. And, I mean, you can tell by the pictures in it. This is another one kind of like, maybe not as much as the Common disparity in styles, but, you know, they were still a little rugged and raw and raunchy and shit, but the griminess you would hear on the infamous, the adult themes, the more gangsterism, the more, you know, it just, they just had it together more. You're a kid when you do some shit and you're like 15, 16, like Juvenile Hell. And you probably got people in your ear and you don't even know. Some people are more wise beyond their years. Not everybody, but by the time you get to the infamous, it's going to be ill. Juvenile Hell, like they were like stepping on like syringes under their boots in the hood and like all this shit. And Hit It From The Back was their single, which is like a raunchy kind of sex single, but it wasn't. It flopped. The first album flopped. It sucked. You know, and then you got dudes like Wu-Tang coming out around the same time as Juvenile Hell, or maybe a little after. I should have checked them there, which was a grimy first album, but they didn't do anything silly. And also, they benefited from the wildest approach of production, not just RZA's actually great beat making, but the rawness of it and the almost using mistakes purposefully and all that, whatever. But, you come to their second album, The Infamous, it's going to go down as one of the hardest hip-hop albums ever, one of the rawest East Coast albums ever, a classic so many people love, great guest appearances, great production, great vibes, so many fucking hits, and none of them are commercials, fuck. You know, I mean, you've got just the fucking, it's one of the best East Coast albums. It feels like the East Coast, mid-90s, Queensbridge, you know, a place that's birthed so many legendary MCs. And it's just hard to the motherfucking core. It's following up. You've got Biggie and Nas have come out. You've got all this East Coast kind of, I wouldn't say resurrection, but you had Death Row dominating for a little while. Now you've got this vibe in the East Coast coming that's fucking heavy. At least in the East Coast as a kid, it was fucking heavy. And, you know, there's a war going on outside, dude, and no man is safe from. And they put you right there, dude. You've got these two young black dudes. These two young cats, and Mobb Deep dudes are little guys. You know, Prodigy, rest in peace. Havoc's the man. I was blessed when I was still doing my thing to open for them a few times, smoke weed with them backstage, hang out. They're little dudes. That's why they Mobb Deep. And they do Mobb Deep. They bring a gang of motherfuckers. I was at SOB's. I was going there with my man Bubba. Shout out to my man Bubba. We hadn't even gone inside. We were going to, it was some Hot 97 show. And we're outside. My man Bubba's talking to Cormega's manager of SOB's, Varick Street, Manhattan. This is the show where Saigon, the rapper, had punched one of Mobb Deep dudes on stage, and they chased him out. We're outside. Bubba's talking to his man. We see Saigon run out and like 30 Queensbridge dudes pulling out joints. It was wild as fuck. They rolled deep. And you felt their like kind of crew love on this album. Like, even if it's two dudes rapping, you got annoyed sometimes and shit, whatever. But like, you felt like in the studio with them, there was a million motherfuckers. You felt like whenever they were chilling, there was. And you kind of wanted to Mobb Deep. They write lyrics about that shit, you know? It was just such a quintessential album. It made you feel great when you listened to it with your boys because you felt like you was, shit, I got my people around too. We're going to go on a little more south on this one, okay? We're going to travel down. I think it's below to Mason-Dixon. My geography sucks. Yes, a little lower to Atlanta, ATL, Outkast, ATLiens. I had this album on a cassette tape back in the day, I'm dating myself. Tapes were huge, man. We'd buy actual mixtapes before they was on CDs, but you would tape like, you know, radio shows. Dude, I was taping 88.9 in Boston. I had a homie who had a friend in New York who was taping 89.9 WKCR, which was like Stretching Bobbito shit, whatever. But he also gave me a few other tapes of just albums, and one of them was ATLiens. He wrote on it, you know, with his hand, and I couldn't like pronounce it. I was like, ATLiens, what the fuck? Because their first album, Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music, which I knew about, but I didn't really check for it. I'll be kind of honest, like I wasn't really peeping a lot of out of the East Coast shit at the time. I fucked with Ghetto Boys from back in the day. I liked NWA when I was young. I respected the Death Row shit, but it was almost like too much of that vibe, the G-Funk shit at the time. And I was, on my East Coast shit. And there wasn't a lot of Southern shit at the time. You had 8-Ball MJG, Ghetto Boys, if you count that back then, UGK. I was fucking with, Ghetto Boys and shit. But I guess 3-6 a little bit too, honestly. That's a long story. But anyway, I knew like the, what's their joint? Players Ball from the first album? Yeah, the one that's the Christmas song. And I liked that. I thought it was cool. And I fucked with Goody Mob too. But, I wasn't like all about their shit. And then AT Aliens, which for so long was like Atlians. I didn't get it because he didn't capitalize the ATL. In the album title, it's ATL capitals E-N-S, I-E-N-S, which makes more sense if you read it like that, but whatever. Fucking fire. I loved it. I was like, yo, these dudes are nice as fuck. I don't even think I knew their names, Big Boy and Andre at the time. I was like, these dudes are fucking dope. This music is fucking dope. The production was nuts. It was outer space. It was grounded. It was soulful. It was ill. They just had a great contrast, complementing each other. Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music definitely put Outkast down as a sonic equivalent to their name, they got a Source Award win. That very legendary speech where they go up there and I think they get booed because this is the height of the East Coast, West Coast beef. And everyone else speaks. And then Andre comes on at the end and I forget, he says whatever. But he does say, all I got to say is South got something to say. That's whatever. He's like, y'all talking about this and that, which has been, used on audio clips on various best of Andre and Outkast tapes. It's in a lot of hip hop documentaries. It's a very legendary speech he gives at the Source Awards, which was, kind of an intense, rowdy award show at times, especially when you got warring factions from the East and West Coast there, Bad Boy, Death Row shit. And that was before AT Aliens. I always thought it was like at the time, but nobody really kind of acknowledged, even when they won the award, people weren't paying attention because the beef was so pressing. Pac, Big, East, West, Bad Boy, fucking Death Row. It was so, it was so encompassing of all of what was going on in hip hop. You had artists who weren't the aforementioned a part of their labels kind of getting either dragged into it or going to bat or taking things personal. It was wild. So then you got this region, the South, they're not involved in this. What do they say on AT Aliens? In the middle, we just stay calm. We just drop bombs. Now, Atlanta really ain't in the middle. It's to the South and all the way on the Eastern Seaboard. The middle would have been like a Texas or whatever. But they're just saying, we ain't the East Coast, we ain't the West Coast. We ain't in this beef. Ain't nobody dissing us. Ain't nobody got us riding for them. We ain't even on their radar. But the first record fucking sold. Shit, we don't want a Source Award. People are fucking with the sound. Not even just our people down here, although they are, because of course you're going to support your own. And the South is huge, because people can argue, how big is the South? Does it go from Texas all the way through like, Louisiana and fucking Alabama, Florida, Georgia, the Carolina? Like, it's a big region, and them is big ass states. And now they got artists that are not just getting notoriety in their area, but they're getting it nationally. The Source is an East Coast magazine, dude. I'm goddamn, you got the heavy hand of Benzino and Boston laying into that shit and what have you. And, Death Row and Pac and a lot of West Coast artists at the time, their prominence was so big that, of course, hip-hop magazines, even East Coast-based ones, were still going to give it a lot of love and shine. BET and MTV were still giving that shine. So it wasn't like they were getting shut out, but the South wasn't getting taken seriously, maybe, or just even acknowledged. And now you got these dudes coming out of there. Yo, we're in the middle. We just stay calm. We ain't involved with your beef. We're not even going to get into this bullshit. We're just going to make fire fucking records. And that's what their second album, AT Aliens, was. Fucking fire, dude. I mean, like the Cadillac Player stuff, like they didn't totally leave it behind after the first album. They kept it there, right? Two Dope Boys and a Cadillac. But these two Dope Boys in a Cadillac are a little intergalactic on a second album. They're a little out of spacey. They're totally on their own vibe. Yeah, there's some Pimp Fly player shit. Big Boy brings that there. Even Dre still kept a little of it on this album, although he will talk about it later that on this second album, after the first one, he wasn't smoking and drinking. He was trying to have a clearer mind, maybe, or a different mind state to start it on a different note. Now, sonically, Dungeon Fam would keep their first few albums in the same, sonic realm in a lot of ways, but maybe like where Dre was going to go content-wise, was going to be a little different, which I think is great because Big Boy would stay a little bit in his realm that was prominent on the first album, and it would lead to this great balance slash contrast of those two. You know, some dudes, like if you take a Mobb Deep, like we was talking about earlier, they're a little both more on the same plane, which is great. It adds something to their projects. And then, you know, it's tough if you're going to have two MCs, a hip-hop duo, and they're not going to be on that same tip. They're going to be a little different. Then they got to balance each other well. And it's like, okay, that way you ain't get too much this, you ain't get too much that. They either pull each other back, but it still has to work. It can't be like the Odd Couple. And Big Boy and Dre, I don't know if anybody else does that better, where they're a little different from each other, but it's so perfect. And like every solo shit you've got of them, you love it. Solo Andre shit, stupid. But I love the contrast of the two. I love the two of them because then it's this great balance, dude. It keeps each other on point. It keeps them sharp. It keeps the whole vibe just there. And now they're intergalactic, dude. Now they're fucking on some ill shit. Organized Noise was just fucking... It wasn't just like the supporting role. Now it's like it's part of the group in a way. The production on this album was so ill. I think going up to their third album, Aquemini, which would be a 5-mic source classic, although this is a classic too, I think that's the production on that third album needed this album to kind of to give it the beef. This used to be my favorite Outkast album for years. Now Aquemini is. Maybe, I don't know why, maybe I burnt this out, who knows. But I fucking love this album. Go bang this motherfucking shit, okay? We're going to do one more, then we're going to split this into a motherfucking two-parter because the Snake Man rambling, going on. So before we go too far, we're going to go to the Fugees, who were slightly sort of in the news recently. Praz just got in some news type shit because he's an informant working for the government, but he got busted with a lot of coke and he's going to jail and all this shit. And it's kind of weird because it makes you think back if you got a key memory like a motherfucker like me does. John Forte, not a Fuji member, but a Fuji, I don't know what you call him, a secondary member, associate, if you will, who had a couple hits in the late 90s. John Forte in the early 2000s or right after all his big hits was busted with like 20-something, 30-something keys of cocaine. That's quite a lot. Got hit with a big trafficking charge. And, I mean, dude, that's not like selling crack cocaine. That's a lot. You're selling cocaine to the dude who's selling cocaine to the dude who's selling cocaine to the dude selling crack. You're up there if you get bopped with 30 keys or maybe it was more. He gets hit with a pretty heavy sentence, especially black dude, celebrity too. They love to nail a celebrity who got busted. Like, let me teach you a lesson, a.k.a. Make an example out of you to the rest of the people. Gets hit with a heavy charge. I'm going to guess it was 20 or more years because he ain't cooperate. He's serving his sentence, and somehow he gets the president at the time, George W. Bush, the son, the slower of the Bushes, perhaps maybe not as slow as Jeb, to pardon him. What's up with Republican presidents pardoning hip-hop dudes? It happens a lot. While fucking Obama deported Doom. That pissed me off. But whatever. That's a side topic. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. Calm the fuck down. Bush W. pardons him. And I believe it was because Praz had gone to a prep school in Connecticut or some shit like that with some woman, some very fancy prep school, apparently. I went to one too, but ain't no senators come out of my shit. A girl he went to school with there became like a high up politician, maybe in the cabinet of Bush W, or just enough pull to talk to him. And they got fucking Praz pardoned. He had a 20 something year sentence, mad keys of coke. He's let out. He ain't snitched on nobody. He ain't cooperate. They let him out. Now we got motherfucking Praz, an actual Fugees member, the least impactful and well known of the Fugees, because you got Lauryn Hill and Wyclef. Praz gets in the news for some wild shit. Anyway, let me get back to it. Second album is the one that most of y'all know, The Score. That's one with all the hits. That's when Wyclef's production started taking from older soul songs and songs where the melody was already kind of in your brain. You kind of knew this, even if it was subconscious. And all you got to do is you change the lyrics to some of the songs. In some, they don't. But you change the lyrics to some of the songs, keep the same melody. Maybe you alter the beat a little so it's not a sample, it's an interpolation. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. And now you got hits. Their first album, Blunted on Reality, doesn't really make an impact. It's the early 90s. It was 94, so it wasn't even really early 90s. Now we're mid-90s, but they still kind of were rapping a little early 90s-y, whatevs. Salaam Remy, who was a producer, I fucking love. He was heavy on Blood and on Reality. He would go on to do a lot of shit for Nas, a lot of shit for Amy Winehouse, whatever. He was great. But they had the Nappy Heads single, and which was probably the only reason that kept their name alive to even get the chance for the sophomore album. But they had Boom Baff, which wasn't great. Like, Heads weren't really checking for him, but Nappy Heads got him a little notoriety. If you just get one song that kind of catches on, even if it's not a big single, okay, the labels might be like, okay, we'll give you a second chance. Okay, we'll give you that second fucking chance. All right? Blunted on Reality is their last fucking failure, at least as a group, okay? The Fugees would go on to be huge, and then, Lauren and Wyclef would have very large, successful solo careers. Even John Forte would have some hits. I'm not quite sure if Praz really did. Maybe that's why he's in the news for this wild situation. But The Score takes the world by storm. Far from a sophomore jinx, it smashes fucking records, dude. Huge fucking singles. The people that don't even like hip-hop are fucking singing along and listening to it. Wyclef's genius use of these well-known melodies, these old songs. I mean, Killing 'Em Softly, they didn't even change the lyrics to that shit. It was the same melody, the same lyrics. I don't know what the cut that... Christ, I'm stoned out, blanking on the fucking... Who sang the original? Roberta Flack. Depending on who owns those original masters, the labels, the artists, I don't know how much they had to cut off to them. Maybe they didn't. Either way, this album is huge. And then Wyclef's The Carnival, Lauren's The Miseducation, Lauryn Hill, those albums are insane, huge, Grammy-winning smashes. So their second album, definitely no fucking jinx, dude. The sophomore smash, The Score. And gonna close out fucking, version number one, part numero uno, dude, of the sophomore jinx. Or is there really a sophomore jinx in hip-hop? I will have the second version of this. I almost said the second album, which was like, fucking the sophomore album. I will have the sophomore installment of this podcast. Hopefully it don't jinx right after this, which will include more of these sophomore albums that were far from jinxes, that were fucking dope, whether they were commercial smashes, critically acclaimed fucking legendary installments in this music realm of the world. How many times have I said fucking realm today? God damn. And then I will touch on a few of the fucking sophomore trash, jinx, crap albums that you wish you never heard. Not as many as I'd fucking liked. If you know of any second albums of hip-hop artists that were fucking crap, regardless of how good the first one was, That fucking tank that flopped or that was made fun of. Maybe they had one big single, but they got ripped apart and shitted on. Let me know, because I would love to talk about those. I couldn't find as many when I looked it up. Off the top, I couldn't find as many second albums that sucked compared to first albums. So yeah, let the Snake Man know. If you feel so inclined, which I know most people don't. I don't do it either. I get it. Go, if you're on iTunes listening, yeah, rate and review it. Most people are now listening to podcasts on Spotify. I don't think they give you that. If you fucking read it all, or you like dark comedy, true stories that are funny, sad, a little sensitive, but hilarious and crazy, my books, Quicksand, The Waiting Room, they're available a lot of places online. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kindle eBooks, I read the fucking audiobooks, certain stores. Go grab those shits. Follow me on Instagram at Jake Frazek, JakeFrazek. At Damaged Goods Podcast, at JTheS on Twitter, at JTHES, all that shit. Yeah, number two of the episode, the sophomore installment, coming fucking ASAP.